Hi again, everyone. This is Mark Movsesian. I'm the director of the Matone Center for Law and Religion at St. John's University. And this is another episode of our podcast series, Legal Spirits. Legal Spirits is a series on cases and issues in law and religion. You can find past episodes archived on our website and also on streaming platforms like Apple iTunes and Android and Spotify. If you like us, we encourage you to subscribe. Well, in this episode, we're going to take a little bit of a detour from current events and talk about a play that was first performed 400 years ago, Shakespeare's Measure for Measure. And this is a great play for us to consider, those of us who care about law and religion, or those of us who care just about law generally, because of all of Shakespeare's plays, I think that Measure for Measure most starkly raises the questions of law and justice and law and religion that we talk about a lot here at the Center. And to discuss this play, I'm joined today by an old friend of mine, John McGinnis. John and I go way back. John is the George C. Dix Professor of Constitutional Law at Northwestern University Law School. John and I have known each other a long, long time. We've talked about this play before and other things. And I should also mention that we've actually recently done a reading group about this play here at St. John's. So the issues are really very, very much in the forefront of my mind. And I'm really looking forward, John, to discussing this with you.
Well, I'm certainly looking forward to discussing it with you, Mark. One of the things that struck me in reading the play was how one looked at the play very differently as one got older. This is a problem play. It's often called a problem play. And the problems seem more obvious to me. And I think that's because you understand them a bit as you
Well, I wouldn't know about getting older, John, but I do know that it is. I do know that it's a problem play, and the reason that we call this a problem play is that although it's a comedy largely because of formulaic reasons. I mean, it ends with a wedding, actually three or four weddings, depending on how you count, and that makes it a comedy because conventionally a comedy ends in a wedding and a tragedy ends in a funeral. But actually, for a comedy, it isn't always quite so funny. Its main themes are political and sexual corruption, deceit, hypocrisy, injustice. And scholars have interpreted the play differently down the centuries. Now, I should say the play's title alludes to a passage in the Gospel of Matthew. Do not judge that you may not be judged. For the judgment you give will be the judgment you get, and the measure you give will be the measure you get. And in fact, the Duke in Act 5 alludes to this passage when he says that, you know, there's going to be Angelo for Claudio, death for death, measure for measure. As I say, there have been various interpretations, but we're lawyers, John and I, we're law professors. And so in this discussion, our main concern is going to be with the play's questions about law and justice. And the central dilemma of the play is that human beings cannot be trusted to enforce justice fairly. And we're talking in this play specifically about God's justice. This is 400 years ago, where there would not have been the separation of church and state that we have today. Achieving God's justice, which is never separate from God's mercy, is just not possible for human beings. And yet, without some code of law, without some judging, society simply can't function. And that dilemma really remains with us today, even though our view of church and state differs greatly from Shakespeare's time. So, John, what I thought I'd do is we'll go through the plot very quickly for those people who don't know it. And then, John, you and I will talk about some questions regarding law and justice in the play. So when the play begins, Duke Vincentio announces his sudden departure from Vienna. He doesn't explain why he's leaving, but he leaves his deputy Angelo in charge. Later, we find out why the Duke has left. For 14 years, it turns out, the Duke has not enforced the law in Vienna, especially the law with regard to vice, prostitution, gambling, things like that. And things are out of hand in Vienna. Vienna is a dangerous place. Prostitution is rampant. Venereal disease is rampant. You get the sense that Vienna is not a good place to walk around late at night with a lot of money. So the Duke says, we need to clean this up, but I can't be the one to do it. I want Angelo to do it because Angelo is known to be very strict. Well, the first thing Angelo does is enforce the law against fornication, generally sex outside marriage. And he decides to prosecute and sentence to death a guy named Claudio, who has gotten his fiancée, they're engaged, has gotten his fiancée with child. Now, Claudio has a sister called Isabella. Isabella is about to enter the convent, but she's persuaded to come and try to plead for her brother, Claudio, with Angelo, which she does. And Angelo falls in love with her, falls madly in love with her. And this puritanical judge tells her, if you will have sex with me, I will let your brother live. And of course, she objects to this. She's horrified at this. But she realizes that if she tells the story, nobody will believe her because of Angelo's reputation and also the fact that Angelo is the judge and people will just take his word over hers. Anyway, the Duke finds out about all this. The Duke is in Vienna in hiding. He's in disguise as a friar. And he tells Isabella, I have a fix for this. Angelo, it turns out, was engaged to a woman called Mariana years before. And he broke off the engagement because Mariana lost her dowry. So Mariana still loves Angelo. And the Duke, disguised as the friar, tells Isabella, we'll have Mariana sleep with Angelo in your place. This is the so-called bed trick. It's a conventional comic device. And that way, your brother will be released. And you won't have to give up your chastity. Everything will work out fine. Okay, so the bed trick works. Mariana sleeps with Angelo. He doesn't catch the trick. But then Angelo double crosses everybody because Angelo figures, you know, Claudio, when he gets out of prison, is going to be pretty angry. I'm not sure what he's going to do about this. So it's better to get rid of Claudio anyway. So he orders Claudio to be executed. Then there's another comic byplay. They figure out a way to send somebody else's head to Angelo, not Claudio's head. But the Duke tells Isabella, your brother is dead. He doesn't reveal the fact that Claudio is still living. And he says, when the Duke returns, you should publicly accuse Angelo of all these crimes. Okay, so now the Duke comes back in his own person to Vienna. And just as he had asked her, Isabella accuses Angelo in front of him in public. There's a big public scene, a big public, I guess you'd call it a show trial. Eventually, the Duke is revealed. It's revealed that he was the friar, so that he knows everything that's happened. Angelo confesses and asks for immediate sentence of death, but the Duke doesn't do that. First, the Duke has Angelo marry Mariana, and then he tells Mariana, now I'm going to execute Angelo, because the only reason I had him marry you was so you would inherit his money as his widow, but now we can just get rid of him because he's been such a terrible person. And Mariana says, no, I still love him. I'd like his life spared. And she turns to Isabella, and she says to Isabella, will you please plead for me, plead for Angelo, for forgiveness for Angelo. And the Duke says, again, there's this beautiful scene, very dramatic scene. It's all a show trial, of course, but it's a very dramatic scene. And the Duke says, there's no way Isabella will pray for your brother. There's no way Isabella will forgive him. And then Isabella does. And she kneels down and she asks for mercy for Angelo because she says, look, he was trying to do the right thing in the beginning anyway. And, you know, we should have mercy on him too. It's a beautiful dramatic scene. And then the Duke reveals that, in fact, Claudio is still alive. Everyone is reunited. Claudio marries his fiancée. Angelo has married Mariana. And then the Duke, kind of out of nowhere, says to Isabella, and I'd like you to marry me as well. And Shakespeare doesn't let us know how Isabella responds, but that's the end of the play. Okay, so that's the nutshell here. That's the nutshell of the plot. I've left out some of the comic elements of the plot. John, did you want to add anything?
Yeah, well, I wanted to begin describing one of the problems that I saw really for the first time, maybe because I'm a law professor, is the craziness of the law that's being enforced. I don't believe that in Elizabethan England there was death for fornication. I think a very high percentage of births were out of wedlock at that time. And of course, this is an attempt to enforce a divine decree by a human law, by a draconian law. And of course, that's the problem. No one is going to enforce laws with punishments that are so deeply against human intuitions of justice. There's a part that you didn't mention in the play, which is a... some of the low-life characters suggest that it's impossible to enforce laws against prostitution. And they're right. If you look at Western civilization, you certainly can't enforce them with these kinds of draconian punishments, given the frailty and of man and its ubiquity. So that's the first problem of course these laws aren't being enforced. That's the problem. It's a problem with the law. It's not so much a problem with the enforcers. And I think that's pretty clear that drives the
play. I wouldn't quite agree with you there, John. I think that, look, it is certainly the case. This would have been seen as draconian. And I should have pointed something out here, which is Claudio wants to marry Juliet. It's not as though he's abandoning her. And I think that most people, including a Christian legal system, would have said, okay, well, that is a kind of justice. He will marry the woman. He'll make her an honest woman. He'll make the child a legitimate child. And that's what justice requires. So I agree with you that it is seen to be the case that I would agree with you that this is draconian, I should say. But I wouldn't go so far as to say that this law is a crazy. I mean, we have laws against prostitution today. I don't think it's impossible.
The punishment is completely out of line with the offense, and that's why it's not going to be enforced. That's the difficulty, right? Maybe this is wrong, and there should be some punishments, but our human intuitions is that this punishment doesn't fit the crime, and that's the real problem. I think what a sociologist would say about this law, rather than some problem of the
right. So I agree with that, and I think that's a theme which gets us actually to the first part of the play, the first scene in the play that I want to discuss. So of course I agree with that. The punishment doesn't fit the crime here, and we have a discussion in the play. So I want to turn to Act Two, Scene One. And I just want to read a little bit of this, John, and then we'll talk about this, because I think this sets up very much the question that you are raising about punishment and crime. So here's Angelo. He's coming in. The scene begins. He's talking to Aeschylus. Aeschylus is an older counselor to the Duke. It's kind of strange that Aeschylus was not left in charge, actually, but he wasn't. Angelo was. And the two of them are discussing Claudio's case and the proper punishment. So here's what Angelo says. Angelo says, "We must not make a scarecrow of the law, setting it up to fear the birds of prey and let it keep one shape till custom make it their perch and not their terror." And then Aeschylus answers him, "Aye, but yet let us be keen and rather cut a little than fall and bruise to death. Alas, this gentleman whom I would save had a most noble father. Let but your honor know, whom I believe to be most straight in virtue, that in the working of your own affections, had time cohered with place, or place with wishing, or that the resolute acting of your blood could have attained the effect of your own purpose, whether you had not sometime in your life erred in this point, which now you censure him, and pulled the law upon you." Okay, let's stop there just for a second, John. So John, what does Angelo mean when he says we must not make a scarecrow of the law?
Well, that the people will recognize over time that a scarecrow is not a person and therefore won't obey, won't take any account of a scarecrow. That's his concern.
Right, and so he has a point there, doesn't he? Because after all, look, the laws have been ignored in Vienna for 14 years, and we see Vienna of the play is totally a mess. As I say, it's not a place where you'd want to walk around late at night. So he has a point there, right? If you have lots of laws, you never enforce them, you're going to have a totally chaotic society.
He has a point there, but you have to have laws that are in some accordance with human intuitions, or you're not going to enforce them. That's really the problem. So my view is they need a new set of laws. That's really what drives the
problem.
See,
this is where I disagree with you. It's not that they need a new set of laws, really. And of course, nowadays we wouldn't view this in the same way. The idea that you got your fiance pregnant and would marry her, many people today wouldn't blink an eye at that. Most people wouldn't blink an eye at that, but this was a different society. It's not so much, I think, John, that they need different laws. They need a different approach to how you enforce the laws. And this is where Aeschylus comes in. And to my mind, I said this to our students at St. John's, this is a really nice juxtaposition of law and equity. Because listen again to what Aeschylus says. Aeschylus isn't saying we need new laws here. Aeschylus is saying we need to think about how we are going to enforce this one. Here's what he says again. Let us be keen and rather cut a little than fall and bruise to death.
Well, except the law, and here I think I disagree a little too, is that the law permits, and may indeed require, someone to be executed for this. That's part of the law. It's and to be sure, one can give some sort of equitable, perhaps mercy, pardon for the law, but precisely because this law is so draconian, it can't really be enforced equally, and therefore is going to give discretion to the enforcer. And that's the problem, right? It gives discretion to the enforcer and therefore is likely to lead to injustice. So I do think that in the setup of the law itself, it is a generator of injustice by having a punishment that's so out of keeping with our sense of justice that it can only be tempered by mercy, which of course depends on the
Well, you
enforcer.
say that, but I don't think Aeschylus would be saying this if he thought there weren't some room in the law not to put Claudio to death. I mean, Aeschylus seems to say, look, we don't have to do it this way.
That's maybe true, but still the possibility of putting people to death is what creates the possibility of injustice, right? Precisely because things are, if they are equitable, they depend much more on man's judgment, which is, of course, a theme of the play, which can be easily overborne by their
Right.
desires. And so it's very important to have a law that doesn't depend too much on judgment, and that's why it's important to have punishments that are the maximum punishments that are in keeping with our
Well,
intuitions of
that's interesting. That's a
justice.
slightly different view than I would take of this. I would say that it's really you can't avoid having judgment in law, and that there's always going to be some sense in which you have to rely upon the good faith of the judge. Now, here's an example of where it goes spectacularly wrong when you rely on the good faith of the judge. But I mean, if Aeschylus were in charge here, we wouldn't be having particularly this problem.
I point out, of course, if men were angels, right, we wouldn't have these problems, right? We have to understand laws, from at least from my perspective, of the kind of people we have. And that's why it's very important not to have punishments that are out of line that may be remitted at the discretion of the judge. We want to make sure, in fact, this is a debate really about sentencing, about should we give a lot of discretion to judges to sentence, or do we want to make sure that they have to follow some rules? This seems to be a dramatic example of some a rule that's just completely out of kilter with our sense of
Your
justice.
reference, John, to Madison, to if men were angels, they would need no government, does, I hadn't missed this before. Of course, the central character of the judge here is called Angelo. And so I wonder whether or not Shakespeare had some ironic sense of that in mind as well. Okay, so we're talking about the judge and the discretion of the judge here. And that leads to another great scene in the play, I think. This is the first interview between Angelo and Isabella, when Isabella comes to plead for Claudio's life. And she makes several arguments to Angelo for mercy, and he keeps saying no. And here's I want to focus on this particular passage between them. So here's Angelo. He says, "Be you content, fair maid. It is the law, not I, condemn your brother. Were he my kinsman, brother, or my son, it should be thus with him. He must die tomorrow." And then she, of course, is very upset by this, and she says to him, "Good, good, my lord, bethink you. Who is it that hath died for this offense? There's many have committed it." And he responds, "The law hath not been dead, though it hath slept. Those many had not dared to do that evil, if the first that did the edict infringe had answered for his deed. Now 'tis awake, takes note of what is done, and like a prophet looks in a glass that shows what future evils, either now or by remissness new conceived, and so in progress to be hatched and born, are now to have no successive degrees, but ere they live, end." And then she says to him, "Yet show some pity." And he says, "I show it most of all when I show justice. For then I pity those I do not know, which a dismissed offense would after gall and do him right, that answering one foul wrong lives not to act another. Be satisfied, your brother dies tomorrow. Be content." All right, John, so let's go through this. What do you make of Angelo's basic point? It is the law, not I, condemn your brother. Is that correct?
Well, it's correct. It may go back to our question of whether he's required to give the death penalty here, right? And that's, I guess, not clear from the play. And if true, in some sense, it is correct that back goes the idea we have a government of laws and not of men. But it's quite clear, of course, that that's not what's going on. That's the irony in the scene, which is that he wants to condemn Claudio so he can leverage this to have an affair
That's
with
coming up, John. I'm
Isabel.
not quite there yet. I want to get to that.
But I think we're meant to think he's already contemplating this, and so that's to me the difficult the difficulty with this. He says, "Well, it's the law," but actually, it turns out to be very much at his discretion. That's sort of the irony to me of
Yeah.
this.
Now, how about this point that she says, look, think you, bethink you, who is it that hath died for this offense? There's many have committed it. So her point is basically, this just isn't fair. You're letting all these other people have gotten away with this, and now he's going to die. To which Angelo says, well, the law hath not been dead, though it hath slept. And he makes a kind of argument about how enforcing the law will actually be more merciful to other people. What do you think of that?
Well, I'm not quite sure what I think of that. In some sense, I think he's hoping for deterrence for other people. This is an argument for deterrence, and I think it's the idea that people will not sin as much. So it really mixes the human and the divine. So in that sense, it's very kind. It leads them away from what is a very serious sin. So in that sense, it's a very good thing. And it's a good thing to have the punishment be so severe, perhaps.
Well, I think, look, I think the point he's making is things have really gotten out of control in Vienna, and they would not have gotten out of control, and people wouldn't be suffering like this if we had enforced the law. So by enforcing it now, I am showing pity to future people who are not. It is, it's been a long time since I studied criminal law, but this is, I think, the general deterrent theory of the criminal law, that you have to enforce this. Okay, now, John, you mentioned what's going on here is while she is trying to persuade him to release Claudio, he is falling head over heels in love with her. And we're meant to think this is, he has never been this way before. He is not a man who knows himself very well. And so he comes up with a plan that, and leads to a second interview with Isabella. He comes up with a plan that if she sleeps with him, he will let Claudio go. And there's another great scene between the two of them where he is, gradually hinting at this. He's like a law professor posing hypothetical cases to her. Well, what if you could get your brother released if you slept with someone, And eventually, either she's not getting it or she's not playing along or whatever. But finally, he just says, look, if you sleep with me, I'm going to let Claudio go. And of course, she says, no. And she says, here's what she says. Sign me a present pardon for my brother, or with an outstretched throat, I'll tell the world aloud what man thou art. I will reveal you for a corrupt judge. And he says, who will believe thee, Isabel? He's very confident about that. Why, John? Why is he so confident no one's going to believe her if she accuses him?
Well, I think he has a few reasons to be confident. I think his office, and he's been described, I mean, he's been left in charge by the Duke. He's an important official, the most important official extant in the kingdom. I think he's been described as having this spotless reputation. Those are really very strong reasons. I think, of course, some people today would add that. She's a woman and he's a man. But I don't think that's necessarily the most important reason. But it might well be another reason. I think she mentions the first two as reasons that she won't be believed. And so this again, what this points up to me is the great difficulty of getting enforcement of laws in a world where, of course, people have differential power, not only different power of wealth, but position, of reputation. And so law is imposed upon a society with all these kinds of differentials. So how can justice actually occur in such a society? People are not, they may be equal before the law, but they are so unequal in all sorts of ways, including their endowments to begin with, that the idea of equality before the law is one that is an ideal, but it's very hard to bring about.
Yeah, I think you're right about all of that. I do think that the sexual politics here, of course, we're looking, maybe it's anachronistic to think this was a lot of it, but I do think it's there. I think that the power differential, he's a powerful man, she's a basically powerless woman. I shouldn't say she's powerless. She seems to have some friends, and Claudio seems to come from a famous family, she and Claudio, but she has much less power than Angelo. And here's how she reflects on this. John, I want to bring this up to you because this is going to come back to a point you made before. This is now getting into a constitutional law point. So he leaves and she has a soliloquy and she says, "To whom should I complain? Did I tell this, who would believe me? O perilous mouths that bear in them one and the selfsame tongue, either of condemnation or reproof, bidding the law make curtsy to their will, hooking both right and wrong to the appetite to follow as it draws." Okay, she's obviously talking about Angelo there, right? A perilous mouth that bears in one and the selfsame tongue, either condemnation or reproof, bidding the law make curtsy to their will, hooking both right and wrong to the appetite to follow as it draws. That sounds like a very much a constitutional law point, John, right?
Well, it certainly, I think, again, is a focus on the idea that law is so easily corrupted because it's always, we only have humans to enforce the law. We have this conceit that government, we have a law a government of laws and not of men, but we only have men to enforce the laws, and they have all sorts of interests. Now, of course, in our society, we generally don't see it as a sexual interest. Generally, people are not leveraging that, but they're leveraging all sorts of other interests. We have worries that our government agencies are bent by special interests. So this is still there are contemporary themes here in the play, even if it seems the particular issues seem a little lurid and to our minds really not very au courant. The actual problem of the corruption of the law, in fact, it may be more, in some sense, systematic today because our government is, in some sense, more open to corruption. We have open government, and that actually means we get all these power differentials reflected in the making of the law and the enforcement.
So I look at this, John, similarly, but I would be a little, maybe even more elemental in this. In what you're saying, I mean, not about the administrative state and things, but basically it goes back to the first interview between Angelo and Isabella, in which he says, "It is the law that condemns your brother." And she says, "No, it isn't, basically. No, it isn't. It's you, and you can release him." And he keeps trying to avoid that, saying, "No, no, it's just the law." And here we come down to just an essential dilemma, which was true in Shakespeare's time in a very different society and true today in ours, which is that you cannot have a simple legal system without human judgment and intervention of some kind. Of course, it's always going to be the judge who decides how to apply the law. And it's impossible to escape the possibility that somehow the judge is going to be led by his own interest or her own interest. There's just no avoiding that. When I read this, the Latin phrase, I can't remember it, who watches the watchers, who guards the guardians, right? What is that?
Quis custodes. Quis custodiat,
okay, right, custodes. I don't know the Latin, but who guards the guardians? And this is just an essential dilemma. So I don't think this is a dilemma that can ever really be resolved. I mean, it was true in Shakespeare's time, it's true in our time. But this is why I think the play is just so interesting, even now, because this is still the central dilemma in the legal system, it seems to me. John?
So thinking about this play, I was impressed by how a famous comment about Shakespeare, that he had a kind of negative capability. This is Keats's comment about what makes Shakespeare great. By what he meant, he really captures all sorts of uncertainties and that nothing really ever lines up. There's really no perfection. There you have all different sorts of perspectives. That's, of course, a very good way, I think, having taught law for 30 years, of thinking about law. It's very hard to look at law from a single perspective. We have all sorts of perspectives in this play. We haven't yet talked about the Duke. I think we have another very big perspective on sexuality from the common folk, who I think quite doubtful about any attempts to enforce sexuality. So one of the aspects that makes this play so interesting, I think, is that there are so many different perspectives that can be made of kind of what is the cause of the mess here.
Well, I agree with that. What is the cause? There's a lot of different reasons for the cause. There are a lot of different causes for the mess, I think, here. Okay, now you mentioned the Duke. Let's now jump now to the end of the play, this wonderful, great scene. As I said, the Duke returns and he puts on this show trial, basically. In some ways, it's very cruel, but it could also be that the Duke has some reasons for doing this. And he puts on the show trial, he walks in, and Isabella accosts him, and she begins by demanding justice. Here's what she says. "Justice, O royal Duke, veil your regard upon a wronged, I would fain have said, a maid. O worthy prince, dishonor not your eye by throwing it on any other object till you have heard me in my true complaint and given me justice, 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 justice." She says it four times very dramatically. And then by the end of this scene, you know, she's come in asking for justice. And by the end of this scene, she's on her knees pleading for mercy for the man who tried to basically extort sex from her, and she still thinks murdered her brother. So how do you explain that, John? I have two questions. One, how do we explain this transformation? Is it believable? And second, what is the point of this scene in front of everyone in Vienna?
Well, to me, the point of the scene is for this trial is really... And this makes me sort of doubtful of the character of the Duke, is really a trial of Isabel. She is giving her a trial. It doesn't seem, of course, that she's on trial, but she's really on trial. And the question is does he want to offer her hand, his hand in marriage? And he's already, I think, observed that she might be a somewhat difficult wife in the sense she might not be a very forgiving person, which a husband might like to have. And so he's actually putting her to a test. And again, he's put Angelo to a test at the beginning, and the play ends less explicitly, but I think implicitly, putting Isabel to the test. And that's, I think, the reason for that. Is it believable? Well, what could change her mind? I think there are really only two things that happen that could change your mind. One is Angelo's wife-to-be asks for mercy. And, of course, she's not been treated very well by Angelo. And so this is an example of mercy that she's given. And then there's the sense, I think, she doesn't know that... Claudio is saved, but there's a sense in which she also recognizes that the Duke, who she only previously knew as a disguised friar, is really on her side, and that may also change her mind about the world. In other words, she doesn't feel as down and out. And can feel, in some sense, from a higher position in society, a greater ability to give mercy. I think the first reason is most important. To me, it still doesn't ring exactly
true. Well, no, it doesn't exactly true either. And it's, you know, but here's what I think about this. So I think the Duke is an ambiguous character. In some ways, he's a very bad character, a cruel character. But he's also, in a sense, educating people. He's educating himself, he's educating his society, his city about this, and he is educating both Angelo and Isabella. So this trial is meant to publicly humiliate Angelo because he needs it. He needs this because he needs to understand how badly he has acted, and he needs to ask for forgiveness. Now, Angelo is so far gone, he can't even ask for forgiveness. He just wants to be killed. It's Mariana and Isabella who ask for forgiveness, but he is forgiven, and we are meant to think he may be redeemed. He's not going to be a judge again, I don't think. But he could be redeemed in this society. And Isabella, too, needs a lesson. because it, you know, as you say, she has had a very black and white view of things and has not been the most forgiving of people. And the reason he does this, he puts her through this very painful process, is because she also needs to have this transformation to become a better person. And her appealing for mercy is certainly from a Christian sense, is makes her a better person. And I think that may be another aspect of this play. This play is meant to educate people about what virtue really is. I mean, Christian virtue, justice is a virtue for sure. And there is justice in this play, right? Angelo and Mariana gets justice, Juliet gets justice, Claudio gets justice, and Isabella gets justice in a way, justice which only comes to her when she is willing to forgive and show mercy. That's how I would look at this. Then there's, of course, the ending scene where he has to marry her. I don't know what to make of that, John.
So one thing I would emphasize, yes, there does seem to be justice, sort of some intuitive justice. There doesn't seem to be any law really at work. In some sense, that's, for a lawyer, what's so interesting about this. After all, the bet trick is hardly a legal matter. In fact, they're actually, the Duke is permitting fornication, right? He could have prevented this fornication.
They're engaged, Angelo and Mariana, right?
But it's not at all clear that Claudio isn't engaged.
In fact, he is. Right? He is engaged.
And so it seems very similar in that respect, and yet, and so this is a way of, again, of, it's not only mercy in the sense of remitting the law, it's consciously violating the law to have a higher sense of justice, to actually create the bond between Mariana and Angelo. And as you say, at the end, it's the effort is to kind of school Isabel, not in the law, but in some sense of mercy, really of right thinking. So the play began with an idea, we're going to make Vienna really better by enforcing all the laws. At the end, we're going to make Vienna better, not really by enforcing all the laws. We also haven't even talked. He remits the punishment of some other miscreant, some other person.
Right, the man who will not die for any man's persuasion.
Right, so that's another aspect. So the opposite of the beginning of the play. So it's really quite dramatic, the ending scene. It really turns the idea that the way we create a better city is by enforcing the laws. The better we create a better city is by enforcing an idea of justice. Whether that's plausible is also open to question, because generally we don't have the Duke manipulating things and seeing how exactly things are going to work. But that struck me as one of the most interesting aspects of the play, the transformation of, we're going to create the good society through law, as we're going to create the good society through a kind of application of intuitive justice, or an understanding of how justice can work in a very situational sense. That's completely different from the idea of we're going to enforce the law. So that strikes me as just, and really forces lawyers to think, because it really suggests, if that's the view, it really suggests that law may not even be the framework for a just society. Although, as I say, it's hard to imagine how that would work at
scale.
Well,
that's a great point. That really is a very interesting point. I mean, again, unless you go back to Aeschylus, Aeschylus never says we don't have the law. He just says we have to figure out a way to apply the law in a humane way. You know, John, when you were talking, I was reminded of Grant Gilmore's great quote at the end of The Ages of American Law. I'm sure you know it, in which he describes heaven and hell. And he says, in heaven there will be no law, and the lion will lie down with the lamb. In hell there will be law in abundance, and due process meticulously observed. So, well, look, this is a great play, and there's lots more we could say about it. John, do you want to have another final comment on the play?
No, that's my final comment is it makes me feel humble about our profession, about how much it can deliver, at least in an ideal sense.
I think we'll leave it there. So This has been another episode of Legal Spirits, our podcast series on cases and issues in law and religion. Our guest this time has been Professor John McGinnis from Northwestern, an old friend of mine. We had a great time with you here, John. Hope you come back again some other time. If you'd like to find past episodes archived, you can find them on our website, lawandreligionforum.org, and also on streaming platforms like Apple iTunes, Android, Spotify, and others. So we'll see you next time, but that's it for this time. Bye now.